Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Happy 4th of July. I keep promising my family I'm going to take a break and take holidays off. But the truth of the matter is, the algorithm really punishes creators when they don't post on their regular schedule. That's just me being totally transparent and honest with you. Plus, this is a story I hadn't heard before, and I wanted to share it with you because it happened on this holiday. There aren't as many details for this story as there are for most of the cases I cover on Tuesdays, so this will be kind of a mini True Crime Tuesday episode, not as long as they usually are. Before we begin, I'm listening to all of your advice and I'm working on my marketing skills. Please like the video, please subscribe to my channel, and if you want, you can join Patreon. We have a really important end goal there that I will talk about at the end of the video. I'm Dining with Death on Patreon, and it really helps. The 4th of July is all about independence and freedom, but so often here in the true crime community, we see people take both of those things from others. They often even take the lives of others. This story happened a very long time ago, but it's just as terrifying today as it was back then. Actually, I think currently this is probably a fear a lot of people have never had before, and it's more prevalent than it has been in the years past. This is the story of a kidnapping on the 4th of July. I'm your host, Stacey Lee. Let's get into it. July 4th, 1956. Our story begins on Long Island, New York. Betty Weinberger has just given birth to a son, Peter, who is 1 month old. It's a beautiful sunny summer day, and Betty wraps her baby in a blanket and places him in his carriage on the porch of their home. The baby was sleeping, and Betty went inside to pick up the kitchen a little bit while the baby was down. She was only gone a few minutes, but when she came back to the porch and looked inside the carriage, her son was gone. Where her son had been sleeping sat a ransom note. This ransom note. In part, the note read, "Attention, I'm sorry this had to happen, but I am in bad need of money and couldn't get it any other way. Don't tell anyone or go to the police about this because I am watching you closely. I am scared stiff and will kill the baby at your first wrong move. Just put $2,000 in small bills in a brown envelope. If everything goes smooth, I will bring the baby back, leave him on the same corner, safe and happy, at exactly 12 noon. No excuses. I can't wait. Your babysitter." I mean, that's just about every parent's worst nightmare, right? In the note, the kidnapper apologizes for his actions, but says he is desperate for money. He says he needs that $2,000 and then the baby will be returned. The note also said not to call the police, but that's exactly what Betty did. Officers from the Nassau County Police Department arrived at the Weinberger house, and Morris Weinberger, the baby's father, rushed home. News reporters caught wind of the kidnapping, and Morris Weinberger gathered them together and pleaded with them not to print anything about the kidnapping for fear that their baby would be harmed or killed. All of the newspapers granted Morris's request, all but one. The New York Daily News ignored the distressed father's pleas, and the story ran on the front page of the paper the next day. 24 hours later, reporters were swarming the area that was supposed to be the drop-off location for the ransom money. Police did, in fact, leave a packet containing fake money in the drop-off spot, but of course the kidnapper never showed up. The day went by, and then another, and then another. On July 10th, 6 days after the kidnapping, the kidnapper called the Weinberger home. He called twice, as a matter of fact, with new instructions on where to take the money. He wanted two different drop-off locations this time. Authorities listened intently and followed his instructions to the T, but the kidnapper never showed up at either location. At the second location, after waiting for hours for the kidnapper to show up, the police searched the area. That's when they realized the kidnapper had been there just earlier than they were. They found a blue cloth bag on the curb with a note inside that told the parents where they could find their baby, quote, if everything goes smooth. The note was handed over to handwriting experts who agreed that the original ransom note and this second note were written by the same person. The following day, July 11th, the FBI went to work on the case. Agents set up a temporary field office near the Weinberger home in Mineola, Long Island. The station was manned 24 hours a day and was under the direction of an FBI agent with a lot of experience in dealing with kidnappers. At this point in time, the only evidence investigators had were the ransom notes. The FBI brought in a couple dozen agents who were then given like a crash course on handwriting analysis, and they began going through writing samples taken from the driver's license division, looking at forms filled out by anyone with a driver's license in hopes of finding some similar handwriting to that on the ransom notes. So think about that for just a minute. You've got a bunch of FBI agents that don't know anything about handwriting analysis. They bring them in, they give them like this 3-hour course on what to look for, and then they just sit down and start going through the piles and piles of driver's license applications in the area. It's really quite amazing. July came to an end, and now they were into August. By August 22nd, they'd looked at almost 2 million handwriting samples, like by hand, not with the computer. And then an agent assisting on the massive task noticed some similarities between the ransom notes and a convict named Angelo LaMarca. Angelo had been arrested for bootlegging, and so his handwriting was on file with the parole office. So was his driver's license application. Investigators began looking into Angelo DeMarca. They learned that he was a taxi dispatcher and also a truck driver who lived with his wife and their two children in nearby Plainview. Angelo had money problems. The family lived in a house they couldn't afford, and he had a lot of unpaid bills. He also owed money to a known loan shark, that had paid several visits to Angelo's home, threatening him. Angelo was told that if he didn't have the money he owed to this loan shark by July 4th, they'd break his kneecaps. Police found witnesses in the area that said they saw Angelo driving around the neighborhood on July 4th. And so they came up with this theory. Angelo had been in the area when he happened to see Betty Weinberger put her baby down in the carriage and go inside her home. Making a spur-of-the-moment decision, he pulled his car over, wrote the ransom note, went up on the porch of the home, and took the baby. The day after the similarities in the handwriting samples were discovered, which was August 23rd, Angelo LaMarca was arrested by the FBI at his house. He adamantly denied he had anything to do with the kidnapping, but then the police brought in the handwriting analysis experts, and they showed Angelo why they were convinced he was the kidnapper. When Angelo saw the evidence, he confessed to writing the ransom notes and taking the baby. Angelo then told investigators that he went to the first drop site on the day after the kidnapping, and he had the baby in the car with him, but he got scared by all the police and the press in the area, so he didn't stop. I mean, did they really think he was going to stop and drop the baby off with them all standing there? Why didn't the police force all of the reporters to clear the area? This is something I just can't really get my head around, but this is what happened. So on the day that the first drop was supposed to take place, Angelo drove away from the drop site and then made a terrible decision. He took the baby out of the car, put it in some heavy brush off the highway exit, and drove home. He just left this poor little baby in the bushes like it was trash. What kind of a person does something like that because they need a couple $1,000s? I can't put my head around it. Angelo told investigators where he'd put the baby, and the FBI agents went to the location. First, they found a diaper pin in the bushes, and then they found him. There was poor Peter Weinberger, decomposed and waiting to be found. In late 1956, Angelo was tried and convicted on kidnapping and murder charges. Angelo was sentenced to death on December 14, 1956. He then began a long series of appeals claiming his rights were violated, that he didn't have proper counsel, all the normal and usual crap these guys pull after doing something so terrible. But in the end, as it usually does, the law won. Angelo Lamarca was executed at Sing Sing on August 7th, 1958, just 2 years after the kidnapping. They did not mess around back then in those days. And frankly, if we're going to have the death penalty, I'd rather see it work like that. Only handed down when you are 100% confident that a person is guilty, and make it quick. Easier said than done, I know. Now, when I first read and researched this story, I was thinking to myself, why wasn't the FBI brought in immediately? Why did it take almost a week for them to get involved on the kidnapping of a child? This is wild and very difficult to believe. But back then, the law stated that the FBI had to wait 7 days before it could take jurisdiction in the kidnapping of a child. I can't wrap my head around that. That's something now, I mean, if a child goes missing now, the FBI is immediately involved. But the citizens couldn't believe this either. And the lawmakers were upset. Some of them weren't aware of this either. And the law got changed forever. President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed a new law overriding the one that said a week must pass and giving the FBI new authority to become involved in a kidnapping case within 24 hours. So that is something important that came from this very sad case, but it's not the only thing that came from this case that's of interest. Angelo Lamarca's son, Vincent, was 11 years old when the kidnapping occurred. He grew up with kids teasing him about his father being a baby killer. So Vincent decided to become a police officer, and that's exactly what he did. He said he became a cop to right the wrongs committed by people like his father and to restore his family's good name. So you know what I'm going to say. Here we have a great example of someone who had every reason and excuse to turn out to be a piece of crap and instead became an amazing person. This is what is so fascinating about this conversation. However, Angelo's grandson was involved in a murder years after Angelo's death, and his grandson told the press, "Murder is in my DNA. I'm predisposed to be a murderer." Two people affected by the same man. One is the son. He becomes a cop and a good guy. The grandson, who has less impact, you know, the guy's dead by then, he becomes a bad guy and blames it on his grandfather. Choices. We all have choices. But we all also have influences. And this is what's fascinating. Now, Vincent DeMarca, let's talk a little bit about him. There was a movie inspired by his life, the son of this terrible man, Angelo. And it stars Robert De Niro, James Franco, and Frances McDormand. It's called City by the Sea. I've seen it several times. It's a good film. And I had no idea it was based on a real cop's life. Doesn't have anything to do with the kidnapping or anything like that. It's all about this cop who's trying to redeem his good name after his father does something really bad. Anyway, it's definitely worth seeing if you haven't. It's from 2002. So I'd imagine it's on some free services like Tubi if you'd like to watch it. This story I felt was very appropriate for today, the 4th of July, because not only did it occur on this holiday, in the end, it is a story about the fact that we are all free to make our own choices. On this day that we celebrate freedom here in America, it's an appropriate story to talk about what we do with that freedom. We have a man who got himself into trouble and chose to do a very bad thing. Then we have his son who watched the whole thing and became a wonderful person, while his grandson became a bad guy. We are very fortunate here in America to have many, many freedoms. Sadly, some of us choose to abuse those freedoms, and that's why there are people like me and like you who are fascinated by those people. In a world where you can be anything, why be a monster? In a world where you can be anything, why be hateful towards your fellow man? And in a world where you can be a helper, why be harmful? Those are questions that plague me every day. We are all entitled to the same freedoms. Some of us have forgotten that as of late. So let me tell you something my father told me when I was very little that stayed with me my entire life. Your rights end at the tip of my nose. I like to turn it around these days because so many people are intent on making sure people who might be a little different feel less than, and I say this to them, your rights end at the tip of their nose. We are all equal. We are all entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As long as you are not hurting another person, you can do whatever makes you happy in my book. As is written on my body, my life's motto, do no harm, take no shit. Kindness matters. Standing up for people who cannot or will not stand up for themselves matters. And each and every life matters. Happy Independence Day, my friends. Stay safe on this holiday and enjoy it. Thank you for being here. I truly appreciate your support and enjoy our interactions and getting to know you. Hit the like button, subscribe to the channel if you want to support me, and if you'd like to join my Patreon, the end goal there is to raise money for cold case DNA that's in storage that cannot be tested because there's no money. We would like to raise money, pick some cases, and close some cold cases. Not only that, but we will get that perpetrator's DNA in the system forever, possibly linking them to other crimes. If you want to donate a couple bucks a month, that's great with me. Happy birthday, America. Stay safe, be kind to each other, and I will see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.